Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast titled Avionics Safety Certification Challenges with UAVs. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speaker today is Celeste Breyer, Field Applications Engineer with LBRA. Graduating from Texas A&M University with a degree in aerospace engineering, Celeste is on the bright new breed of field application engineers at LBRA. After supplementing her aerospace expertise with a spell in the process industries, Celeste joined LBRA to train new and existing users on the best practice use of LBRA software solutions. She now helps to inspire the development of safe and secure applications across the aerospace, automotive, and medical industries. Our sponsors for today's event are LBRA and DSpace. Now I have some short housekeeping announcements. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This webcast will consume about 40 to 45 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. And I'd like to point out some important buttons on your screen. Please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. Then you can use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them larger. Next, I want you to look at the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for the event. The final button I want you to check is that on the console window allows you to enter questions in real time, and we'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a webcast question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the webcast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, we'll make it back to you after the webcast with more information. This webcast will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. And now I'm pleased to turn over to Celeste. Take it away.
Hello. Thanks, John. So, like John said, we're going to be discussing avionics safety certification challenges with UAVs. First, I'm going to give a brief introduction to LBRA and talk about who we are and where we come from. We'll discuss some industry challenges, dive into some requirements traceability, low-level testing and coverage, and then I'll open up the floor for some questions. So about LBRA, we have been in the industry for over 40 years. We are ISO 9001 certified, and we have two certificates that certify us for use in safety-related software development. Additionally, we are active participants in the DO-178C, MISRA-C, and C++, and CERT committees. We have offices in the U.S., the U.K., and India, and we also have a distributor network that covers most of the world, so if you have a location somewhere other than these three major places, we usually have somebody to talk to you. Now we're going to discuss some of the industry challenges that are faced with UAV systems. There are a number of challenges associated with the UAV industry. These challenges include the complexity and length of the source code, the inherent complexity in air and ground systems, and the new spaces that UAV systems have grown into, which interact more and more with our everyday life. There are varied levels of compliance-related skills available. Often, the mandates for a specific project that specify methodologies are less strict than commercial avionics. A UAV is typically not considered at the same safety critical level as an aircraft. They're smaller and can't hurt as many people. Additionally, there have been challenges introduced due to object-oriented technology and model-based design. The different governing bodies for UAVs, the DoD, commercial flight, and UAVs all have different requirements, and therefore there are different authorities for each, which can lead to a lot of confusion when you're trying to certify a specific project that may fall somewhere between more than two, possibly, of these realms. However, adoption of the standards for UAV programs is growing rapidly because of the FAA's recent decision to require UAS and OPA certification through FAA Order 813034.34D. Some of the challenges on the path to DO-178 certification. There are quite a few, actually. So in order to achieve DO-178 adherence, there are all of these challenges that you face, starting with the requirements traceability. They can include linking documents across repositories like doors or design tools, Word documents, or even tests, managing those changes, so changing requirements or design some of your code and test assessing impacts, or possibly even reuse. So requirements of reusing those requirements or reusing code across multiple programs and product lines. There's a coding standards compliance. There are automated tools, checking tools for adherence to certain coding standards, which help to reduce defects early on in the process, and it helps to meet the DO objectives of uniformly designed and implemented systems. Data and control coupling analysis essentially demonstrates that the expected coupling of control flow and data flow per design and requirement is what actually gets implemented. This objective and activity can require a lot of manual review of data elements and control flow across software components, their relationship, requirements, and tests. Structural coverage in DO 178 B and C. This can include statement, branch, and MCDC coverage depending on your level of adherence. It's primarily required to be done on the target hardware and can be achieved by executing both functional and low-level tests. Often, coverage from both approaches are aggregated together, and this can be very time-consuming and often underestimated part of the verification. Target integration testing. When executing functional and low-level tests on targets to measure structural coverage, target constraints such as memory, performance, I/O availability are all very important. Additionally, multi-core and time or space portioned RTOSs further complicate your target integration. It is vital that the testing technology can integrate with these technologies and be qualified. For certain levels, there is object code verification. This addresses 6.4.4.2 paragraph B specifically for level A. And last but not least, the certification of a tool requires generation of management of product or project documentation reports, artifacts, audits, and establishing a chain of custody. So then we'll talk about requirements traceability and what all that entails. As various activities are performed across the specification tree and the application lifecycle, typically different engineering teams must execute these activities. These teams are often separated by physical location and are trained in different engineering disciplines and report to different management structures. This can result in cost and schedule prohibitive inefficiencies and errors accumulating across that lifecycle. LDRA has a verification workflow engine, which is called PB Manager, that brings together requirements, code, and tests at various scopes in a collaborative environment to bridge the engineering gaps and improve transparency across phases of the lifecycle and the teams. Traceability is a very difficult task to complete, so DO 178 specifies that bidirectional traceability is required. Decomposing your system-level requirements down to procedure-level into the code can be quite a challenge, especially with a dynamic development process where you may have requirements changing or your source code changing on a daily basis. When you review your requirements, not only is the traceability important in itself, but the correctness of that traceability is also key. In this image, you can see the requirement text associated with the requirement itself is below, so you can review it to ensure that they're correctly mapped. There are some scenarios in which you'll have improper decomposition. Here, a single system-level requirement decomposes all the way down to a single procedure. This can be a very serious issue. That procedure at the bottom is either very complex, which will require a lot of testing, or alternatively, the system level requirement should have more meat to it. It could be just a very simple requirement. Another scenario for the system level requirement is the all-encompassing requirement. This requirement would cover so many high-level and low-level requirements that a slight change to it could have a major cascading effect downstream and affect all of the related requirements and code. This would cause major restructuring of the code if any sort of change happens to that requirement late on in the project. And this is something that you'd want to take a look at just to ensure that your traceability isn't massively impacted from one requirement. Another important aspect of traceability are the traceability matrix reports. These can quickly identify any traceability issues. In this example, there are three high-level requirements that are not mapped to any low-level requirements. You'll see them highlighted in red. A good traceability matrix should highlight these gaps in coverage so you can quickly identify and remedy the traceability gap. This is another view of the same traceability matrix report. You'll see at the top the three columns of the high-level requirements are highlighted in red on the top row, specifying that they have no requirement that's mapped to them. This view allows you to quickly identify which high-level requirements are not covered. The idea behind all of this is that compliance throughout the lifecycle is very challenging. This includes managing traceability between requirements, design, code, and tests, managing verification workflow and objectives for the DO-178 compliance, or automating your static, dynamic analysis, and testing. The next couple slides will be discussing coding standards and the unit testing portion of that compliance. The LDRA solutions leverage value added at each phase of the lifecycle to reduce exposure, cost, schedule, and compliance-related risk. DO-178 C and B specify that a coding standard is used. Typically, we see a combination of multiple coding standards that give you your custom coding standard specific to your project. There are many coding standards that are out there, and it takes some time to develop a standard that fits your needs. But adhering to a coding standard helps to create high-quality software from the beginning. It's always easier and cheaper to find the issues early on in the development lifecycle with a coding standard than at the end of the project when it's causing a major problem. So by automating software standards checking, this dramatically can reduce the amount of time and energy that is spent on peer reviews or code standardization, freeing up engineering teams to discuss performance, architecture, more application-level development strategies. Using both peer review and automated coding standards checking in conjunction makes the peer review process much more effective. This is the coding standards adherence that LDRA has built into MISRA. And this is what the MISRA mapping looks like, as well as CAST, CERT, CWE. And this is what it would appear as in the TB Manager document or tool itself, with the coding standards mapped to as artifacts to a certain requirement within objective within DO-178. Software written to a good coding standard typically reduces your testing burden as well. Essentially, your coding standard aids in the design and implementation for testing. Often, the number of lines of code, cyclomatic complexity, and the implemented functionality per function is reduced. This makes traceability to low-level requirements much easier, as well as reduces code coverage burdens and promotes greater reuse of your software. For automating the coding standards compliance, this is best done at the developer workstation as they develop. This reduces the need to change the code once the application has been integrated. If developers are using Eclipse, NetBeans, or Visual Studio family of IDEs, standards violations can be brought directly into the IDE to maximize the developer's efficiency. Also, coding standards checking can be done from the command line as part of your build process or from a continuous integration tool such as Jenkins. This can provide an additional filter in your process. Meeting the coding standard is a very economical way of reducing defects. It prevents the insertions of runtime defects and often latent issues that arise much further in the application lifetime. Many coding standards, such as the MISRA family of coding standards, promote writing code for portability. This includes addressing ambiguities in the programming language specifications that compiler vendors interpret different, as well as a variability of silicon and architecture. For instance, if software is ported from one target hardware to another, the cross-compiler vendor can change, and those adhering to MISRA should see few or no software issues arise due to the compiler and silicon changing. This value is becoming more and more apparent as software reuse is increasing. Checking for adherence to software standards like CERT or CWE are ideal for reducing software-level vulnerabilities that leave applications open to a variety of attacks. By adhering to these standards, the attack surface of an application is greatly reduced. Standardizing to a coding standard results in similar look and feel of code of the source code across programs, application, and organization. As engineers move around programs or contribute to multiple projects, their ramp-up time is typically much faster. Another positive side effect is that engineers start to naturally write compliant code. Typically, the back and forth with engineers on interpretation of a standard rule is reduced when you have an automatic coding standard check. And the coding standards can be configured per your organization's needs. Often, legacy code requires a lighter standard designed to focus on runtime errors and obvious defensive coding strategies, like checking pointers for null or defaults in case statements. In other cases, code is often generated from modeling tools, which sometimes generate code to a certain coding standards, like Simulink will do MISRA AC, Rhapsody, MISRA C++ 2008. Additional such rules, such as custom rules or Hungarian notation or naming conventions, can be added as well. In these heterogeneous environments, tool flexibility is essential for practical and scalable deployments. Once your project adheres to a specific coding standard, you can check off the DO-178 objective as fulfilled. You'll see this as the golden colored button next to table A54. This is an example of a report with the source code adhering to the selected coding standard, and that report is being used as an artifact to satisfy this objective. Now we're going to talk about low-level testing and code coverage. So using a unit testing tool can often be a 90% reduction of manually writing low-level test harnesses. Though low-level testing is often encouraged, it can take quite a while to build up a good regression suite. As code bases grow, this becomes impractical. Unit testing allows you to find faults earlier, and it allows you to characterize the behavior of components as you develop and make sure that they behave the way they're supposed to. It also allows you to verify components before they are put into the system as a whole, giving you confidence that the system will work correctly when it all fits together. Structural coverage provides a basis for you to understand and know that you've adequately tested your system enough, and the code coverage also acts as a test effectiveness rate. How effective are your tests based on how much code coverage you're generating per test? In DO-178B and C, often applications attain structural coverage through high-level testing and then apply low-level testing to fill in the holes. Coverage accrued through both mechanisms within the LDRE tool suite can be aggregated. So measuring structural coverage can be a challenge in its own right. However, all levels of coverage can be automated across a wide array of embedded environments. The tools are used, can then be qualified. The types of coverage that may be necessary can include procedure entry point, procedure call coverage, statement, branch, MCDC, path, and objective code coverage or data coverage for level A. DBRun, LDRA's unit testing tool, is lightweight. The probe points are inserted only at branch points, and it has been utilized on various 8-bit systems and multi-core IMA systems. It's fairly flexible with many types of instrumentation, data extraction over your existing I/O channels, and it uses your own build mechanism. It allows for coverage visualization, as you can see the green and the red and even orange in some places here with the coverage on the screen. And there's even test case planner, so there's an MCDC test case planner to help you understand what tests you need to add in order to get your coverage. And then lastly, it aggregates that code coverage from your low-level tests and high-level tests together to get your total picture. DO-178C, Section 6.4.4.2C, states analysis to confirm that the requirement-based testing has exercised data and control coupling between code components. Essentially, this is data and control coupling. Control coupling coverage is ensuring that every invocation of a function has been exercised. Data coupling coverage is ensuring that we have exercised every access to the data. In this screenshot here, it's showing where there is some executed code after running the test cases that were written. In this case, it was just one. This little bit of code will specifically cause some problems if the display command is called before calculate is. The actual speed may be different, and then it would be displaying an old speed. This is a good example of why data and control coupling is important. You could get 100% coverage, branch decision, and statement coverage by a second test case, but it would call case calculate first and then the display command. (6.4.4.2b) and hidden objectives detail getting coverage on the object code. Manually reviewing traceability from the source code to the object code is fairly impractical. Using a tool can greatly reduce your cost. As your performance needs increase, applications are typically increasing optimization, resulting in further difference from the source code to the object code. This is why it's not good enough to do with through just compiler validation. Integration with DBRun will support the object code coverage. And LDRA is able to do this as the parsing technology is developed internally. The moral of the story is that adherence to DO-178 in itself is a challenge, and there are tools out there built to help this entire development process. LDRA's TB Manager helps maintain the traceability to the source code and manage test case regression. The LDRA tool suite can help reduce the cost of authoring tests, linking to requirements, and even performing impact analysis when looking at traceability decomposition. TB Manager also tracks the objective verification for DO-178, as you probably have seen earlier in some earlier slides, simplifying even further the need for tracking this information manually. This specifically is an example of a pass-fail coverage call graph, and in this case, all of the functions and calls that are colored green show that we have full coverage. The call graph acts as a verification artifact for one of those DO-178 objectives. I'm going to talk about qualification now for tool qualification. LDRA, oftentimes for the highest safety critical systems, like ASIL-A, you will need to qualify your tool. LDRA offers tool qualification packages to assist with this arduous process. We have successfully completed over 250 certifications for more than 80 companies. Our goal is to make DO-178 adherence faster, easier, and more efficient, so your time to market is decreased and your software development is focused on what matters, making safe and secure code. I'm going to pass it back to John now for some questions.
Excellent presentation, Celeste. Now we're going to get to a Q&A. We got a lot of questions from the audience, so please keep them coming in and ask Celeste what you want to know about UAV certification. Why don't we start with first question here is, what kind of programming language do you usually see for UAVs?
Sure. Usually for UAVs, we see C and C++. Java is often used for the interface, user interface level as well.
Do you ever come across Ada being used anywhere? That's my own follow-up. I'm just curious.
Yes, we do have some customers that use Ada. I haven't seen it specifically for UAVs, however, so.
Okay. Next question. How does UAV certification affect hobbyists, I guess the folks that fly just for fun?
Well, typically you'll see hobby UAVs are a lot smaller and much less able when it comes to its abilities. For example, the Predator drone has a lot more capabilities than an off-the-shelf RC airplane that you buy from a hobby store. As the UAV size increases and the capabilities increase, that's where you'll see some certification requirements come into play.
I think there are some rules, though, about how far they can fly to close to airports.
Yes.
And such, right? That's where I think
Yes.
Many people think that's not really a safety certification. No, that's just a law, correct?
Right. Yeah, that's FAA rules on where you can fly and how high.
Okay. Next question. What UAVs have been held to these standards, if any?
At this time, really the only UAVs that have been held to any sort of standard are DoD derivatives. So basically, if there's a contract with the DoD, you have to be held to certain safety standards. But that's not necessarily to DO-178 standards. There are, you know, some exceptions that the DoD will make because, you know, there's time constraints and projects that they need completed. So typically, there's not in the market some required UAV certification.
Okay. Next question from the audience. Is LDRA working on a DO-254 compliant tool chain for FPGAs?
Not at this time, no.
Okay. Next question. For avionics systems where the design assurance level, also known as DAL, D-A-L, is determined to be, say, level C based on a failure, contributing to significant increase in pilot workload, does the DAL need to be increased for UAV use since tasks like sense and avoid become simply impossible if the avionics systems fail?
That was a long question.
I think what they're asking is because of sense and avoid, so I'm guessing here from this, is yet really to be mastered with unmanned systems. But because of the extra risk involved with it, they're asking, should there be another level added to DAL for UAVs? Has there been talked
I think
about
it would that? Really it would really depend on what the application was for the UAV. The way I put it, as you know, sad as it is how many people would be injured in a failure. Is it something, a big aircraft that's, you know, size-wise large? In that case, I think it should be, since there's no pilot to fall back on to, you know, help with any errors in the code.
Excellent point. And that is why these safety certifications are in place. They're based on the population of, you know, commercial consumers that fly on an aircraft or might get injured by
exactly.
an and what. Okay.
Exactly.
Has there been talk about that? I mean, of changing that at all? Have you heard anything on that from the government?
I haven't heard anything on that. I know that the FAA was talking about with the 8130.34D requiring UAS certification of some form. But I don't know in the DAL level any changes there.
Okay. Next question. How is FACE, which I think stands for the Future Airborne Capability Environment Compliance, affecting UAV avionics and flight software? Is that something you guys play in or work with?
Yeah, heavily, yes. We are heavily involved with FACE, and I believe over time FACE will become a lot more applicable to UAVs simply because of the government the DoD. They're heavily involved with space. The idea is that they can get a bunch of components from multiple suppliers and put it all together into one big package that will work together, which I think will make a huge role in UAV certification, especially for the Department of Defense.
No, it's about reuse too. There'll be like common APIs or something. Common APIs. And is that something that, and that's mostly the DoD, but do you know if any commercial stuff is being looked at for FACE, or is it required anywhere?
Not commercially that I'm familiar with at this time.
Next question. Well, speaking of requirements, are military UAVs required to comply with DO-178, 254, even FACE? My memory is I don't think they were, but or is it optional, or is there a trend that are they doing more of it even if they're not required to? What are you seeing on the military side?
They're not required to adhere to DO-178 at this time. I'm seeing more and more push towards it, but nothing required. It's more of, you know, they have certain requirements written out but for a project. For deliverables and such, but nothing on the requirement side for DO-178.
Okay. Next question. What is the how does LDRA, how can you make the certification process easier? Well, what makes it hard? I'm going to change this person's question. What makes it hard, and how can you make it easier? Is it a time-consuming thing? Is it the money that they have to spend?
All of the above. there's a lot of paperwork involved. There's a lot of certifications required. You have to have a DER, or a designated engineering representative, come in and inspect your process and your documentation. And additionally, any tools that you use, specifically to software, you have to qualify that tool, saying, you know, we understand any cause and effects of this tool. It does affect the, you know, end result, or it doesn't. And then you have to document why you believe that. So it causes quite a bit of a headache for anybody to adhere to DO-178 simply because they have to qualify everything they're using. And documentation is just a huge headache. So if you have something that helps kind of keep all of your documentation organized into one central location, that's a huge help. And that's what LDRA offers with TB Manager. Is it kind of manages all of that documentation for you so you can run your test cases, regress those test cases if any changes happen in your code, or if you have, you know, your coding standards adherence happening, as well as that traceability. The traceability is very important upstream and downstream, just due to the decomposition of those requirements. Additionally, we offer those tool qualification packages for each level of those testings. So when you have, you know, a supplier, a tool vendor like us give you all of the documentation essentially that you need, obviously you still have to test it in your environment according to DO-178. You can't take your project out of the environment and have us test it for you. It has to be tested on your hardware, but we provide you with the documentation, test cases, et cetera, that help you along that process.
And if the certified software or code has to be reused on another, they want to use it on a different platform, does it have to be recertified, or is that kind of what FACE is dealing with, or what are the avenues there? How much is it recertification? If they have to do it again, it seems like an expensive headache.
So recertification, they wouldn't have to recertify the software, the tool that they're using, as long as it's the same version of the tool. So, and the rest of the recertification process, I believe, is if it's, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe, though, it is, if it's been proven in the field and it's certified, it should be okay to continue using, as long as there are no changes, which is a big caveat to that.
As a follow-up, we had a question come in, I think that I'm going to jump ahead to this other question here because I think it's a nice follow-up. What are the most common mistakes you see your customers or actually just any avionics supplier making during the certification process? And are any of them unique to UAV certification?
So a lot of the problems that I see are not instituting any sort of coding standards from the get-go and not starting off with designing test cases and requirements. Usually it's a little bit of a scramble to keep up with development, to keep their requirements up to date, as well as their test cases and their coding standards. If you implement something early on in the process, it becomes second nature to continue through, versus at the end, you know, when you're almost done and you just have the certification to do, it's like, oh, what did we do? You know, you have to go through everything that you've created so far, and it can cause a big headache when you're trying to certify something and having to jump through all these hoops right at the end.
Sorry. What would UAV certification be fairly new to the industry? What makes LDRA more reliable than other products on the market?
Sorry, dry throat. Give me one second. LDRA has been involved in DO-178 style things for over 40 years. So even though UAV-specific certification is new, aerospace industry is not new. So we have a lot of experience with certification for DO-178. We have, you know, over 250 TQSPs or tool qualification packages that we've provided to suppliers. So I think that gives us a strong leg up in the industry since we've been in it for quite a long time.
I have a follow-up to that, but I have some questions that come in from the audience I think you might want to answer first. What was presented, your presentation, what was really specific to UAVs in your process?
Sure. So UAVs, specifically, they aren't required to have any sort of regulation at this time, and that's kind of why we jumped to DO-178 more specifically. With UAV specifics, I guess the major thing is the FAA is starting to regulate the UAS domain with the 8130.34B that they've implemented.
8130.3.D. Can you explain? Can you say that again? And
yeah. FAA has 8130.34D, which is an order that they have instituted. It's airworthiness certification of unmanned aircraft systems and optionally piloted aircraft. So this is an order that they have instituted, and they have been working on updating. But at this time, you know, obviously it's not enforced with DO-178, but I see the industry is going more towards the regulation of UAVs.
And I know there was some work being done a few years ago when they were trying to come up with a common control station, and there was a certification aspect to that. It's a slow process, and I think what you're saying, if I'm right here, is that we guys know how to do the avionics certification for manned aircraft. They just haven't come out with the it's a bureaucratic thing that you're waiting on a little bit, the regulations.
Exactly.
And then you got to figure out what they want first before you can really apply the best practices for manned. Is that what I'm hearing correctly?
Yeah. Yep. That's exactly right. Yeah. We just have a lot of work done in the manned aircraft, so it's very applicable to unmanned, and the fact that it's just not regulated yet, but it's on the horizon. So.
Okay. Next question. This person said they missed the part where you in your slide on UAV challenges. Could without going back to the slide, can you give a quick recap of what the main challenges are for UAV certification?
Yes. Let me find my slide. I got to make sure I'm on the correct one that they're talking about.
I think it was the one you had three or four on the left, five on the right, had a longer one
yep.
on the right. Yep. Okay.
Yep. Okay, got it. So with UAVs, with challenges there in the industry itself, the complexity and length of the source code is just getting bigger, you know. As the complexity of the systems are increasing, the source code has to follow. There's complexity in air and ground systems that's also affecting it. The new spaces that UAV systems have grown into, you know, they're talking about drone delivery of, you know, packages or, you know, so this growth of the UAV industry itself is starting to become more and more challenging. The airspace is getting crowded. and then there's also so many different compliance-related skills that you need to have in order to, you know, adhere to any sort of requirements here. Let's see, I'm trying to read through it. And then also the different governing bodies with DOD versus commercial flight versus, you know, a specific UAV, there's conflicting, at times, conflicting information. So that adds another challenge to understanding what exactly you're trying to meet, which requirements you're trying to meet. And sometimes you might fall under more than one of those categories. If you're trying to create one project and use it on multiple applications.
Thanks. And in some ways, it's hard to keep up with the technology itself because you have people just building UAVs themselves, and you can download one on the internet, download a flight
exactly.
Pilot, a payload, yeah. Attached to your UAV, so it's hard to keep up. In some way, the devil's out of the bottle. I'm sure I'm messing up that cliche. But next question from the audience, it's going to be question 21, Celeste. How is UAV certification different than AC certification, and what CFR are applicable for UAV certification? I'm not sure I know exactly what the acronyms are, but perhaps you do.
I'm not sure I do either, actually. The AC standing for aircraft certification,
Probably manned aircraft certification. How will that be different? And I think you were kind of answering that before when you said it's still unsure yet because you're not sure what the rules are looking for. Or is that...
Exactly. Yeah, it's still unsure at this time. It's just until they come up with a final product for us or product not product standard to go by. We don't really know what the applicable information would be. You know, as the question earlier was asked, you know, should the DAL level increase because there's no pilot? We don't know if that actually will happen. That's definitely a possibility.
And so how you guys prepare for this is you're kind of speculating or kind of figuring how you would certify the aircraft as it is now. I mean, it might change, the technology is developing fast. So is it more kind of taking the manned model and applying it there and answering some of those unanswered questions on your own before it's the only way you can do it,
yeah.
I don't think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question from the audience. For a university project, would DO-178 apply for such projects? How long would it take to get certain certifications? I guess for a university, I'll add to this person's question, isn't there a price tag when it comes to certifying a DO-178? Kind of expensive.
There's a huge price tag. Yeah, there is a huge price tag. Typically, I believe research falls under a different category. When I was in college, actually, I worked for a UAV group. And we didn't have any certifications we had to fall under. We flew it on a private airfield that the university had, and there was no extra certifications that were necessary. So I think the research tag kind of puts it in a whole different ballgame.
And typically for non-research, but for maybe just a commercial avionics application, how long does a certification take? Is it a long process, or does it really depend on the investment of the customer?
It's a long process. Usually you have to have your DER come in and inspect your process multiple times. And there's no guarantee you'll get the same DER every time. So if one of them comes in and says, okay, well, I have a problem with how you're doing this thing, you fix it. The next time somebody else comes in, they don't have a problem with what the first DER had a problem with, but they have a problem with something else. So that's kind of the checks and balances associated with the certification. But it also can be very time-consuming and difficult to complete.
Okay. Next question. Is tool qualification part of the SOI-3 audit?
That's a good question. I am not certain, and I will get back to that question.
Okay. Next question from the audience. Can you comment on the best practices for code revision control?
Code revision control. So typically I see code being placed into a repository of some kind with version numbers, like SVN has version numbers on it. Are they specifically asking about code review, like coding standards and unit testing, or the code itself?
Okay. Next question from the audience. Do you require formal verification during the certification process? I mean, is formal verification during the certification process? Question 27.
I see that. Does it require? I'm not sure what it require is. Does it require formal verification? Verification of the results, that's what our tool qualification package does, is it verifies your results. So essentially what we do with tool qualification is we have certain tests in UK, in the headquarters, that they run on the tool, and then we send you those same tests to the customer to test in their environment, which would formally verify that the results in both settings are the same.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Thank you. Made sense to me. Next question from the audience. Are there any new updates coming to DO254, 178, or FACE that we should be aware of down the road next couple of years? I know C is only a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so for DO254 and 178, I'm not aware of any at this time. For FACE, definitely. FACE is constantly changing and updating, and I foresee that FACE will become more and more dominant in the aerospace industry as a whole, not just UAVs, just because the Department of Defense tends to be a driving force for a lot of development in general.
Yeah, and I've commented on that. I've covered FACE for a few years now, and what drove it came out during the whole sequestration and DOD budget cuts, and it really is a light with some initial investment that the DOD can save money in the long run by reusing all these APIs and these codes across different platforms. It's similar to what Rockwell Collins did with the CAS program for helicopter avionics many years ago. And Rockwell is a big part of the starting FACE. But yeah, it's getting a lot of momentum. But you know what version, what FACE is at right now? What's the latest version? I don't know off the top of my head.
I don't know off the top of my head either. I'd have to look it up.
Okay. Next question from the audience. What is the typical learning curve for the LDRA tool chain for a standard project?
Sure. So we have, with the tool, we actually sell a 3-day training course for the engineers. So we would come in on site and teach them all the ins and outs of the tool. Typically, I would say it's another few weeks after that of just, you know, questions as they come up. But those first 3Ds are critical in really getting a hang on to what the tool, how it works, and what exactly is going on under the hood. Once they understand, you know, under the hood what's happening, it makes it a lot easier for the users to, you know, debug their own issues. Sometimes, you know, there are things like, oh, a header file is missing, and how do I know that from this error? Well, once you go through the training class, it makes it a lot easier to figure out on your own.
Okay. For tool qualification, if the configuration file changes, then do we want to requalify the tool?
If your configuration files are changing, you'll need to requalify it as long as that configuration file affects the results. Typically, what we do for the qualification package is we get a bundle of the configuration. You purchase the tool, you set it up in your environment so that it's exactly how you want it to be. You send us those configuration files, and that's where we would, you know, test it in our environment and then send you the test cases to ensure that they're the same. So if that configuration files are changing, they haven't been fully tested. So, yes, you would need to requalify the tool.
Okay. Next question from the audience. Looking forward, what do you think some of the safety certification challenges of the next couple of years will be that avionics suppliers need to keep abreast of?
So in the next few years, obviously, the airspace is going to just get only more crowded. It's kind of like space itself. You know, they talk about how space is crowded with all these satellites and dead satellites, et cetera. Our airspace within, you know, just the Earth is going to get more crowded with more and more UAVs, obviously. So I think that's something to keep in mind. So that will be a definite safety challenge, you know, kind of collision avoidance and that kind of thing with UAVs specifically. Avionics in general as a whole, obviously more and more people are flying commercially. So that just in general is becoming a busier market. And I think that's going to be a definite challenge for everybody as we move forward.
And as that trade show says, it's exponential. commercial market, right? Next question. Do you have any comments on the application of RTCA guideline DO333, formal method supplement to DO178C and DO278A? Anything LVRA doing in that area? That would be question
34.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh.
I just thought. So, do you have any on the application? Not at this time. I know that I've reviewed that DO 333, but I haven't. We don't really have any comments on it in particular.
Not at this time. Okay. Next question from the audience. Apart from DO 330 or DO 178C, do you have any specific standards for tool qualification?
So we have the DO 178 for tool qualification in general. Well, there is the ISO 26262, which is actually more automotive, and their highest safety level, which is ASIL D, they do actually have to qualify the tool as well. Past that, I'm not sure of any industry standards that require tool qualification. There probably are similar ones in, Europe, or the European Space Agency and their regulatory bodies, but I'm not sure of the names specifically.
Okay. Next question, how is the tool chain qualified in avionics?
This would be kind of along the same question earlier where you have the DER coming in and auditing your process. And so you would provide the tool qualification documentation that we help you with to the DER. And we actually have a DER on staff, so we're very familiar with the process. And so we try to make it as easy as possible and provide you with everything that you need in order to make this as painless as possible. So you would just provide them with the documentation that you filled out in your environment and the test case results, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you. Time for a few more questions. Where is all the tooling going with multi-core support for certification? And what is the future of multi-core and DAL aircraft, DAL ATC requirements? Is it going to happen? Yeah, there's a lot of multi-core talk in the certification world. What are you guys seeing?
Yeah, actually, so we are working on a multi-core version of the tool as well for unit testing because we see that same question quite a bit. So I see multi-core definitely happening in the future, and it's only going to make things easier for everybody involved. I'm not sure about what the DAL requirements are specifically for the hardware on the multi-core setup, but I know that that's something that we are pursuing as a company.
I think there's been some discussion on that, definitely at different levels. There might be different opinions based on the events I've attended on when the European version of how to certify components such as FPGAs and things like that. So I don't know if that's been finalized yet, actually. And next question from the audience. What is the criteria for requalification in avionics?
For requalification, it would be the exact same as your initial qualification. So if you have... assuming something changes. So if you have your setup and you're making changes and you need to requalify, you would need to go through the same process. Thankfully, in most cases, you have all of your documentation for the initial qualification and only need to change, the things that have changed. But you would still need to have a DER come in and inspect your process.
Okay. Next question from the audience. You got one more question here. So where can the audience see LDRA or a demonstration of your tools? Are there any events you'll be attending over the next few months? And I know you have teams that you send to companies, too, to kind of do an evaluation. Talk to that.
Yeah, definitely. So LDRA is heavily involved in the FACE committees, and so if you attend any of the FACE events, you'll likely see us there. If you want a live demonstration of the tool, that would just be contacting us. We'd be more than happy to give you a live demonstration of how the tool works, and that would just be a sales option that you'd have to contact.
And do any trade shows or
events?
Will you be attending that? Were there any other side outside from the FACE meeting? Will you guys be at AVSI Exponential Show? We have a booth there?
I'm not actually sure. At this time, I actually have to ask our marketing director, and he's in the UK, so unfortunately I'm not certain of which other conferences we'll be attending.
Oh, okay. But for sure, the FACE. And if you're looking to find out more about FACE, this is to the audience, go to www.opengroup.org/FACE. Open Group is kind of the nonprofit behind the FACE Consortium, and they can provide you with the information on their upcoming meetings and such. And can you repeat your website one more time as well?
www.aldire.com. pretty easy there.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? And I'm going to see. Yep, okay. And for more information on that, and once again, opengroup.org/face. And anything else you'd like to say before we sign off? Anything you'd like to summarize or regarding the questions?
Nothing for me, but thank you all for your time.
Excellent. And that brings us right up to our time limit for today. Sorry we could not get to all of your questions today. Someone may get back to you after the webcast with more information. I want to thank Celeste for speaking today and LDRA and DSpace for sponsoring the event. Please remember that this and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded and used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This webcast will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending. I look forward to seeing you in future Open Systems Media webcasts. Goodbye.